to the Country Hour. I'm Warwick Long. Today, we take a drive around Robin Vale on the Murray River to see some horrific conditions farm workers are living in.
We've had some huge issues with overcrowding in homes. And you can see, as I drive you by, the condition some of these premises are.
They're lean-to sheds in some cases, and this has got almost like rags hanging down over the top of a caravan to keep the heat off it.
Under lean-tos like this, it'd be like sitting in a frying pan when you're cooking. Have a look at the one on your left there. You know how many people in there? Have a look at the back. It's just past a joke.
Also today, we'll have some good news for the dairy industry. Details shortly. Thanks for joining us on the Country Hour. But we'll start with a business that we don't talk about that much of on the Country Hour, certainly in southern country hours. Live exporter Wellard is loading a boat in Portland today full of cattle to ship to China. Our reporter Jess Davis is there and can tell us more. Welcome to the Country Hour, Jess. Take us there. What have you been looking at today?
Hi, Warwick. Well, you might actually be able to hear behind me the trucks loading and the cattle actually getting on the ship as I speak. So I've got 2,000 beef cattle, mostly Angus and some crossbred Angus, heading to China. And as you said, it's the first shipment of beef cattle for Wellards.
And has Wellard been on the charm offensive today to show Victorian journalists what they do?
Absolutely. Well, you know, it's not often that journalists get access to this process. So we actually went down to the pre-quarantine area to see the cattle before they got on the trucks, and then we all came down to the port to see the whole process. And as the media spokesperson said to me, that they're not ashamed of what they do, and they're happy for journalists to come and have a look, and they want to show people what they're doing. So they're very proud of this first shipment that's going to China and the deal that they've got. They've got $3 a kilo for the cattle they're sending over there, and they actually announced 12 months ago that they were going to make this shipment, but they've waited for the prices to rise a bit to make it more economically viable.
Describe what you can see there and what the whole setup looks like.
Yeah, so we've got two trucks full of cattle at the moment. They're on they're sort of a raised hydraulic platform that they're walking up to get onto the ship. So I've got the guys who have brought them from the pre-quarantine area who are sort of herding them through that boarding process. And then obviously we've got the staff on board who are getting them settled on the boat. I've also spoken to the chief vet today, and he spoke about the process of keeping them healthy on that voyage. And he's done about 30 voyages with live animals. And he said it's their long days. You get up, you know, before light to check on them, have some breakfast. And it's basically just continuously checking up on them and making sure they're all right and treating them when they need something.
Yeah, live export, obviously quite a controversial process and subject of many campaigns against it. Has Wellard, being the business operator here, been keen to show that or talk about what it does to ensure welfare, like the vet you were talking about then?
Absolutely. They're really trying to push that the animals are looked after, that the conditions they're in are excellent. They are up to animal welfare standards. This shipment, there's only 2,000 cattle on a ship that can host up to 7,000, so they've got quite a lot more room than they would normally have. And as I mentioned before, the media spokesperson said, you know, we're not ashamed of what we're doing. We look after our animals, and there's no issue with what we're doing here. So they have absolutely no problems with animal welfare, which is what they're trying to show us today.
And currently in northern Victoria around Echuca, there's a ban on a lot of these animals going live export to China because of a discovery of blue tongue in some animals. Some of the bodies that show blue tongue has existed in those animals was discovered. Was there any comment on that discovery and if it affects this shipment of cattle at all?
That's right. So I spoke to Wellards, and I've spoken to some producers whose cattle was actually on board the ship as well. They're not worried about blue tongue coming further south. Obviously, they don't want it here. There's quite a rigorous quarantine process for the cattle that are going to China. So they have to be on the property that they're bought from for 90 days so that they know that it's a non-blue tongue area. And then they're kept in quarantine for 7 days at the pre-quarantine area before they load the ship. So, you know, there are a strict quarantine guidelines that they have to adhere to, and part of the reason that they're shipping out of Portland is because it is a an area that's free of blue tongue, so the cattle here are good and healthy and they're able to ship to China.
Does Wellard see a future in exporting from Victoria, particularly to China?
Absolutely. This is a bit of a test case for them. They are really hoping that it's a success and that the prices stay strong for them so that they can continue shipping them to China. And the commercial deal they've made with the Chinese company, they've actually, it's their first import of live cattle. They've built a new abattoir and new facilities to start this process. So they're hoping, obviously, that this will be the first of many coming out of Portland.
And how long does this process take? Do you know when the cattle are meant to be arriving in China?
It's an 18-day journey, provided that the weather is okay. And then once they arrive in China, they have to be slaughtered within 14 days of arrival. And then the ship turns around, so it's about a 36-day round-trip journey for the ship.
And as far as everything that you've been looking at today, has anything surprised you or taken you aback or something that you weren't expecting to see?
Well, I've never been close to this process at all, so it's been absolutely fascinating. And speaking to some other journalists, one of them from Stock and Land actually has been on a 13-day voyage himself to do a story, so he's a little bit more experienced than I am. But no, it's just fascinating watching the cattle in the pre-quarantine area and the whole process. And, yeah, I've learned a lot.
I'm sure we'll see more and hear more in the coming days. Jess, thank you.
Thanks, Warwick.
That's rural reporter Jess Davis at the Port of Portland. As you heard, where Wellard are loading their 2,000 head, ready for the vessel to China. An 18-day voyage, as you heard there, if all things are good weather-wise. Maybe you can tell us what you think about that. You can send us a text at the Country Hour. You always can. 0467 842 722. Do you see this as being a benefit to Victorian beef farmers with Wellard loading ships now to China? 0467 842 722 to text us on the Country Hour. You might want to keep those numbers handy as we move away from beef and talk dairy now, with some rare good news, I suppose you'd call it, for the dairy industry. A new dairy factory is to be built in northern Victoria to produce milk powder, butter and cheese. Just a few years ago, the small town of Gergari near Rochester in Kyabram was losing its tomato processing factory when Heinz packed up and left the country. Now the town is celebrating as large-scale food manufacturing returns. Milk trading company ACM, which supplies the Pactum dairy plant at Shepparton, is expanding and will build its own factory at Gergari. Michael Old is the managing director of ACM and has big plans. Michael Old, welcome to the Country Hour.
Thanks, Warwick.
Tell us about this plan for a new dairy factory.
We've secured a site at Gergari next to the old butter factory, which then became the Heinz factory, tomato processing site, and we aim to build a new facility there which will have the capability to process up to 200 million litres of milk.
It's all at a time when we've been hearing a lot about difficulties in the dairy industry. Your company's growing and now looking at building something new. What's the secret?
I'm not sure if there's any secret, Warwick. I think it's just a matter of trying to stick to the knitting, and our model's always been about reducing the volatility in the supply chain, not only for the farmers, but also for the customers. And I think if we can find something that makes sense and present a product to the we'll just keep taking one step after the other forward.
And why Gergari?
Well, logistically, it's in the middle of where our milk pool is. Also, the site has some infrastructure there, existing infrastructure, which also is helpful. Access to gas, electricity, as a water treatment plant as a part of the purchase. So there's some infrastructure there which is advantageous.
And are you confident you can get the workforce you need to Gergari, a number of years after the tomato processing facility in the town shut?
Oh, look, I think the resource pool for labour is quite good. If you do a 50-kilometre radius from where the site is, you've got Rochester that's just up the road, which is obviously closing down in, I think, the end of January. So there's some talent from there that we can tap into. We're not that far from Echuca, close enough to Shepparton, Kyabram. So, no, we're not too worried about being able to attract the right people.
And tell us about the detail of the factory. What are you going to produce there and how much milk will you require?
Yeah, well, the facility will be set up to give us some flexibility. We've got a couple of milk pools. One, we've been growing an organic milk pool, which will be roughly around 50 million litres over the next couple of years. And we have our non-organic milk pool. So out of the 200 million that we could process there, we could anticipate about 50 be organic and about 150 non-organic. We'll be making products that, you know, some specialty powders, butter, cheese, but mostly aiming at retail ready products or products that can go straight into ingredients.
So we're looking at domestic products here or export products?
A combination of both. So we have some domestic markets we'll cater for, plus we've also got some good export opportunities we'll tap into.
Have you got the milk you need to supply this factory already?
Yeah, look, in our existing pool, we've got about 330 million litres of milk. So some of that milk will go through this processing plant. Over time, we may look to go out and try and attract a bit more, but that's depending on the business model. If we get the business model right, the ability to attract milk should follow.
And I suppose in the last few years, there was obviously a situation with Murray Goulburn and Fonterra, but just as a trend, dairy farmers have been willing to move around quite more willingly with their milk and go to different companies, whoever's paying them the best price. Is that an opportunity for your business, or is that a threat when you think about locking in supply long-term and building up a factory such as this from the ground?
Oh, no. Look, you know, we've got to be competitive with what we do, so every decision you make, you've got to make sure that you've got the farmer in mind. So, you know, price is one thing, but also, you know, reducing volatility we think is also important. You know, it's no good getting a high price one year and then the following year the market crashes and you're getting a very low price. So try and find some consistency of pricing and something that makes sense on a longer-term basis, I think, is our aim.
And you mentioned the organic supply too. Obviously, organic milk has been getting a premium in the market, but have you found a willingness for farmers in your supply regions to move towards organic?
Yeah, no, we've been quite pleased with the uptake. It's not for all farmers. It depends on their farming model, but some farmers are, you know, farming a lot closer to organically than what they really realise. So that transition to go to organic hasn't been a big step for some farmers, and for those farmers, it'll work out quite well.
So what's the timeline then for this factory, this greenfield site, to become a fully functioning operation?
Yeah, we aim to be up and running for the 2018 peak, so around October next year, September, October, we aim to have some milk going through the site.
So that's a lot of work to do between now and then.
Yeah, but look, there's a lot of work that's gone into prior to this, you know, making this announcement, so it's just a matter of finalising, you know, supplies and the like, and then we'll start to get into it. But yeah, no, it's a tight schedule, but we're reasonably confident we can hit it.
And will this factory have any impact at all on your existing deals to supply milk to the Pactum dairy operation?
No, it'll complement it. It allows us to be able to balance out the flows of milk more efficiently, which then should enable us to be able to pass those benefits on back to the farmer.
And Northern Victoria's had a difficult period of time when it comes to the dairy industry. Should we celebrate news like this more, do you feel?
I'm not sure whether we celebrate it or not, but you know, I think what we are demonstrating that we believe there's a future in Northern Vic, Southern New South Wales for dairy. I still think it's a great place to produce milk. Obviously, some of the challenges have been around water and the uncertainty around that, so we need to get those things sorted out so everybody knows what rules they've got to play by and get down to building a business model that's going to work.
Michael Lord, thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks, Warren.
Michael Auld, the Managing Director of ACM, speaking there, building a new factory at Gagari in Northern Victoria. After all we've been speaking about in the dairy industry, it's amazing to be talking about a new processing plant. You can give me your thoughts on that by sending a text 0467 842 722. On the Wellards shipment to China, a live export shipment being loaded today at Portland. One text here says, why not sell China beef carcasses? And that's the question, isn't it, that between a live export and just beef exports as well? Well, we've got some news in the beef export front as well to China today on the country. The ban on beef from six Australian abattoirs ending China has been lifted. The federal government has announced today that the ban, which began back in July, will now cease and exports can resume from some of Australia's biggest beef traders. I spoke to livestock market analyst with Mercado, Matt Dalgleish.
The announcement came that they've been given the all clear again now today. So Steve Trevor was on the radio in the morning just announcing that scenario that happened just with regards to mislabeling of product going into China. So those six are now clear to operate again.
So take us to the history here. It was about a labelling issue for Australian beef going to China. The right information wasn't on the meat when it was getting there. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. From my understanding, the labelling on the outside of the box, or the bigger kind of labelling package outside, didn't match the inner labelling on the product inside. So there was really an administration error by the sound of things. So there wasn't anything to suspect there was any quality issue at all. It was more just that things didn't match up when you know, the officials in China were ticking off this label to that label up there.
So what does this mean to the wider beef industry from an Australian perspective?
Oh, look, it's a good thing, certainly for those six involved. It's a good thing because there was a fair amount of money involved in those consignments going across. And then obviously the loss of access into China for those six would have been, you know, significant for them from a microeconomic perspective for those businesses. If you look at the broader Australian marketplace and the flows of beef that go externally, you know, to all the different destinations, you know, China's an important player, but they're certainly not the volume sizes that we send to Japan or South Korea or indeed the US. So from a bigger perspective, it's a little bit of a drop in the ocean if you're looking at those overall volumes annually.
So you would have expected whatever beef that was caught up in this ban to have found a new home at one of our other major markets?
Yeah, look, yeah. And from a macroeconomic perspective, looking at that broader export market, it was reasonably insignificant, but I wouldn't want to downplay it, the impact upon those six, and certainly for that short period of time, it was you know, it was something that was an area of concern, and just goes to highlight the importance of making sure that when things are being sent to places, particularly like China, that have a fairly high, you know, food security kind of regime there, that things are done from an administration perspective, they're done, you know, done appropriately.
And as far as the time that this ban has been in place for, has this been relatively quick or slow in terms of being lifted?
Look, if you cast your mind back, there was a ban that China placed on Brazilian product, and that actually was to do with a quality issue, and you know, the scandal that happened over there with regards to some tainted meat being sent out and got captured both in Europe and in China. And so China was very quick to place a ban on that, and clearly because that was an issue of safety in terms of the product. But that one was lifted within a week and a half. In this instance, the six abattoirs that were affected, it certainly wasn't good for them. But, you know, from a Chinese perspective, there would have been no real rush to push it through as quickly as they did the Brazilian one.
And the abattoirs involved in the July delisting included JBS's Beef City and JBS Primo facilities in Queensland and New South Wales, Kilcoy Pastoral in Queensland, Northern Cooperative Meat Company at New South Wales, Australian Country Choice in Brisbane, and Thomas Food International's Murray Bridge plant. Should farmers expect buyers from those facilities to be back out in the marketplace, or will there not be a real change at the farmer level, I suppose, for what they see in the meat industry?
Yeah, look, certainly when the announcement was made, there didn't appear to be any real disruption to the sale yard, I guess, from that perspective in all those areas. So, and certainly, like I said, if you look at the broader volumes of what you were talking about then, I don't know, discount that it was a big amount in terms of monetary value for those particular processes, and certainly that was, you know, a concern. But again, when you look at that broader marketplace and the overall volumes that go through both the sale yard and then the volumes that end up overseas and other destinations other than China as well, that wouldn't be significant enough to have made an impact upon sale yard prices or the impact going back to the farmer. Yeah, it didn't happen on the reverse, and it won't happen now. You know, they're back on again.
Livestock market analyst with Mercado, Matt Dalgleish, speaking there. You're listening to The Country Hour. It's 24 past 12, and we'll move from beef to horticulture now, with Australian farmers continuing to celebrate the frozen berry scandal, with consumers buying more and more of the fresh product Australian farmers produce every year. But you'll still only find imported blueberries and raspberries in major supermarket freezers. And as Danny Grinlay reports, Australian growers are confident enough to plant more berries, but very few are investing in freezing technology.
Berries have been in the spotlight for all the wrong reasons, but Australian growers have celebrated every negative headline.
I think it certainly has been a positive, if you can see it that way.
Jonathan Eccles is chief of the Raspberry and Blackberry Growers Association. It's been nearly 3 years since frozen berries imported from Canada and China were linked to hepatitis A cases.
And that incident probably gave more recognition to Australian grown berries, and production is trying to keep up with consumer demand.
Existing growers are planting more, and new farmers have entered the berry game. Mr. Eccles says farmers now have the confidence to trial new berries.
We've got blackberries at the moment, but they're only available for 4 or 5 months of the year. New varieties will be coming in, which will give us 12 months production. Golden raspberries will come in, and then there's the new black raspberries.
Supermarket giant Woolworths confirmed its customers were buying almost a third more blueberries and raspberries since this time last year. The Blueberry Growers Association says there are 20 to 30% more blueberries being planted every year. Vice President Gurmesh Singh doesn't pin all of the positives on the import saga, but says it certainly helped.
People are definitely preferring to buy fresh blueberries over frozen.
But reality is Australian growers can't supply fruit all year round, and you won't find any of their frozen raspberries or blueberries in the major supermarkets.
Frozen's a very tight competitive market, obviously, because people can do it overseas for cheaper than what we can here.
Mr. Singh is part of a grower cooperative which examined the opportunities in frozen products and couldn't see the incentive. Costa Group, which controls 45% of Australian blueberries, confirmed it was not considering frozen products. Raspberry farmers have much more second-grade fruit, but Jonathan Eccles says growers lack the confidence to compete with overseas farmers.
The cost of investing in the machinery and the freezing capacity is extremely high, so it's a very risky investment.
Tasmanian raspberry farmer Richard Clark kind of took that risk. He's a processing raspberry producer, so already had the harvesting machinery needed.
What we did 2 years ago was put in a cryogenic liquid nitrogen freezing tunnel.
So he could now freeze individual berries instead of bulk blocks of processing fruit. The investment has paid off.
We've doubled each year over 3 seasons. We've expanded outside of Tasmania now. We're selling frozen berries into Victorian, South Australian, Western Australian and soon Queensland independent grocers.
But the major supermarkets are yet to bite. Coles actually helped fund Mr. Clark's freezing technology, but is yet to stock his product.
They'd like our product, but we're not quite in a stage of us having enough capacity or having cut out enough costs, I suppose, to make it an attractive offer.
Coles sells 500 grams of imported frozen raspberries for $4, while 350 grams of Mr. Clark's Australian frozen raspberries are $9.90. He says Australian consumers will shape the future. Will they pay the extra? I asked some Victorians how they felt about their berries.
I never look to see where they come from, ever.
I don't buy anything that is in the freezer when I go to the market because frozen berries, if it's not imported from overseas, it's actually good for you also.
I prefer fresh.
What if I told you that the berries that were frozen were from Australian growers? Would that make a difference?
Not really, no.
Do you buy frozen berries from the supermarket?
Never.
Did you before the story
yes,
broke?
I did, yes. I don't know where it comes from and how it's dealt with before I get it, so I prefer to buy fresh and freeze my own.
What if I was to tell you that there were Australian berries that are now being frozen? Would you opt for the frozen then?
Yes.
Probably about a month after it passed, we were back buying frozen berries. I don't think we'd look at whether it's grown in Australia as a factor. It's pretty much just we bulk buy it, I guess. So
we are off the land. We're farmers ourselves. Yeah. If there was an Australian product, I would go Australian.
I remember the story.
Were you put off frozen berries at all?
No.
Oh, well, you tend to go back after a while, don't you?
If you were given an Australian-grown product, would you pay more for that?
Within reason, yes.
That's some thoughts from some Victorian consumers there, ending that report from Danny Gridley. You're listening to The Country Hour. The news and weather are fast approaching. But before we get to that, a few of your thoughts coming in to us on 0467 842 722. Jeff says, g'day, Warwick. Live cattle exports. Is this the jobs and growth we heard about from our politicians? They didn't mention the jobs and growth would be in China. That's from Jeff on 0467 842 722. John, on the Chinese beef ban being lifted today, he said Chinese concerned about incorrect labelling. I purchased archery arrows from China and they were labelled fishing gear. A camping stove was kitchenware. Perhaps it may have been a good excuse to try and jiggle the market to their advantage, says John from Sale. You can keep your thoughts coming in to 0467 842 722. And I have noticed a few of you on Twitter in the last 24 hours, dairy farmers commenting a lot on our program from yesterday, bringing you some thoughts of Murray Goulburn suppliers and shareholders about the sale, and also particularly the thoughts of those who left supplying the company but felt the need to comment at the AGM still as shareholders. If you want to listen to that podcast, that program, like those people are, you certainly can. You can listen to the Country Hour podcast every day. You can find that either at our website, abc.net.au/rural, or wherever you get your podcasts, really. In Apple Podcasts, you can find it there if you'd like. Victorian Country Hour, you can listen to our podcast and send us your thoughts, what you think, whenever you want. On your terms. Get involved. We'd love to hear from you. It's 12:30 on the Country Hour right now, though. Let's find out what's making news in regional Victoria. Robert French has our headlines today. Good afternoon, Robert.
Afternoon, Warwick. Conservationists have blockaded a disputed area of old-growth forest in East Gippsland to prevent VicForest from logging there. Forestry compliance officers are investigating the Princess Cunt Coop in the Kewark Forest north of Orbost this week after more than 6,000 people wrote to the state government to protect it from logging. The Environment Minister, Lily D'Ambrosio, says VicForest won't be allowed to log until the investigation is complete. We can't say when that will happen. Homicide detectives have been called in to investigate the death of a man who was hit by a car in the Grampians. Police say the man was struck by a vehicle at Fiennes Creek at about midday yesterday. A woman who was known to the man was arrested at the scene. Victoria's Court of Appeal has upheld a 9.5-year jail term against Horsham man Harley Woodford for killing his ex-girlfriend's 3-year-old daughter when he stomped on her 2 years ago. The Department of Public Prosecutions had appealed the sentence, saying it was too lenient. Woodford will have to serve a minimum of 6.5 years in prison. The Australian Transport Safety Bureau says engine failure was behind a fatal plane crash in Mildura 2 years ago. Tony Mangan of Mildura was killed when the light plane he was flying crashed in Mildura in November 2015. An investigation has found the plane's engine was starved of fuel but could not determine why. And Ballarat will host two AFL games at its newly upgraded Eureka Stadium as part of the 2018 fixture released today. The Western Bulldogs will take on the Gold Coast Suns in Round 7 on Saturday, May the 5th. They'll return to Ballarat again in Round 19 to face Port Adelaide on July the 29th. For more stories, head to our website, abc.net.au/news.
Thanks very much for that, Robert.
Streaming right around the world, you're with the Country Hour, Australia's longest-running radio show.
Indeed, we are Australia's longest-running radio show, but we're not the longest-running Facebook page, but we'd like you to like it all the same. We've got Victorian Country, our Facebook page up. We've been celebrating letterboxes over the last few weeks, some of the crackers from regional Victoria. If you've got one to send it to us, we'd love to see it. If you just want to enjoy silage wrapper letterboxes, there's a few quirky little ones. There's a Lego Man letterbox. There's a Ned Kelly one. Head to our Facebook page, Victorian Country Hour on Facebook. There's all of that, and there's the much more serious stories as well that we put up there for you. Give us a like. We'd love to have you part of our community. Let's find out what weather's doing in our community at the moment, and if that rain has cleared off. Chris Godfrey's at the Bureau of Meteorology for us today. Hi, Chris.
Yeah, hi, Warwick. How are you?
Yeah, good. Has that rain left us now?
Look, I think over fairly large parts of the state, it's certainly drier than it was yesterday. But if you're down on the coast, especially, you know, down around the Bass Coast, around Phillip Island and the Mornington Peninsula and parts of East Gippsland, and also extending up through into West Gippsland, there are still showers present, and they're producing generally light falls, though. The instability that we had yesterday is now largely vanished, and the MS has become a touch milder. So it is still cool in the south, and we'll see cloud increase further during the day as well. So you might even find some parts of mountain and southern Victoria that started off dry might just pick up a light shower during the afternoon, but not really too much around to bother the rain gauge scorers. Unlike yesterday, the daily totals from 9 a.m. this morning, there were some reasonably impressive ones, especially around outer metropolitan Melbourne in the east and northeast. We had these scattered showers, and some of them did have thunderstorms embedded in them, and also hail showers as well. And then as that line of instability moved into East Gippsland later in the afternoon and during the evening, there are also some fairly good totals in the range of about 15 to 20 mils in East Gippsland as well. In Ensay, which is high up in the Tambo catchment, had the highest daily total. They got 22 millimetres, and their next best was Montrose in outer eastern Melbourne with 18. So I think most of the good good rainfall was basically found in central and eastern Victoria yesterday. But and then by the time we sort of got into the southwest, of course, there were reasonably good falls still, but they were generally in the order of about 3 to 5 millimetres, and they tended to clear up during the later part of yesterday. But anyway, just I guess moving back on to today's weather and how we're looking for the rest of the week, we're really now moving into a fairly stable pattern that's not really going to change greatly in the broad scale right through the week. So basically, it's as a 25-word summary, it's pretty much cool, mostly cloudy in the south with showers that are usually light. The north should generally be dry, becoming milder with periods of cloud. I guess to go into a bit more detail, we can sort of see the temperatures today have recovered a little bit compared to the quite chilly, well below the average values from yesterday. But certainly in southern Victoria, you're not going to see much above 20, and it's really only in the Mallee where we would see maximum temperatures above about 21 or 22 during today. As I said, that sort of light shower activity will extend further inland a bit during the afternoon as the cloud cover builds up, because the air mass near the surface is still fairly cool. So there was still a potential for a few snow showers around the Alpine peaks during this morning, but we would have also expected them to clear up, so mainly just rain showers, and they'll also start to ease as we move into the evening, because the sort of activity which tends to just build up during daytime, and then once that source of ground heating shuts down at sunset, then the showers become more isolated and contract to the coast. Winds will basically continue to be a fairly moderate sort of west to southwesterly. A bit fresher if you're in coastal East Gippsland. The front that cleared last night is now basically moved into the Tasman Sea and become a low which has deepened and become pretty intense. And that low is going to become a near stationary feature for the next couple of days. So it means that sort of very fresh southwesterly flow will continue about the far eastern part of the state for the next couple of days, along with scattered showers. So it's probably that part of the state, the highlands of East Gippsland, which could see some continued decent falls through the next couple of days, thinking maybe as a week-long total from Monday to Friday, they would probably most likely get above about 25 to 30 mils. So at least that part of the world, which has not seen too much rain during the past few months, will get a decent drink. But I think for the rest of Victoria, it's mainly going to be fairly patchy. We will see bursts of shower activity sort of peaking during Wednesday night as we have a weak front which is embedded in the southwesterlies that will just struggle up into Western Bass Strait and move onto the coast Wednesday night and then mostly die. So there will be a band of showers that will then move further into southern Victoria during the early hours of Thursday morning and then largely break up. And then we have another slightly stronger front coming through during Friday morning. So in the wake of that front, there'll be a further burst of showers, scattered showers around mainly central and eastern Victoria, perhaps some shower activity to start Friday in the southwest, but once again, probably not really expecting more than a few mils for most areas. But in those sort of regions, which tend to get higher totals in west to southwesterly airflow, you could get some local higher falls pushing up to about 5 or 10 mils. And that second front on Friday will lead to a freshening of west to southwest winds down on the coast. So the only warning we have at the moment is a coastal wind warning, just a strong wind warning in the far east of Bass Strait, and then we'd be likely to see strong wind warnings through Bass Strait during Friday. But then as we move into the weekend, we do finally and gradually start to see a moderating and clearing of conditions. It will still be quite cool and chilly on Saturday, mostly dry. There may just be a couple of morning showers down on the coast, and it will be cloudy further inland as well. We are sort of looking at a bit of a deep development of moisture that sort of streams across from South Australia and sort of clips the far northwest of the state around the Mallee sort of during Friday and Saturday. At this stage, we're really only classing it, though, as a slight chance of producing useful rain. It'll be more likely a factor in adjacent parts of South Australia and also into New South Wales. But there will be still a fair bit of cloud of that. So whereas northern Victoria will likely be partly cloudy and mild on Wednesday and Thursday as temperatures start to even creep up towards the mid-20s. It will become cloudy once again on Friday with temperatures up in that part of the world dropping down to the low 20s, and that will likely continue into Saturday as well. But finally, as we move to Sunday, that's when we are set to have a dry day across the whole state. The high that's sort of been lurking in the bight in the southern ocean that's been driving this sort of days of southwesterly flow starts to move closer. So it means that conditions will dry out and winds will start to tend a bit more southeasterly across the state as well. Not really a great rebound in temperatures for southern Victoria on Sunday. They'll still be around that sort of level of the high teens, maybe pushing 20 in a few centres in Gippsland, but at least they will rise back up to the low to mid-20s in northern Victoria for Sunday. And then to start next week and the second half of what will be a very long weekend for many people, once again, the situation's only going to change fairly slowly. There is a bit of spread among the models, but I think the good news for the long-term forecast, because now we have to talk about the Melbourne Cup, of course, is that most of the model difference now seems to be over central Australia. So the differences that are there don't really have a huge bearing on the weather for Victoria for next Monday and Tuesday. So we look set to have a warming trend to start next week in the north. We'll be back up to the mid-20s on Monday and then even getting up into the 30s in the far northwest during Tuesday. Dry conditions for most of the state, but developments in the central part of the country might possibly have a bearing on the far west of the state, especially as we go through to next Tuesday. So Cup Day, I think, for the vast majority of Victoria will be dry and fine. Mild temperatures in the south around about the high teens to low 20s. In the northwest, though, it's set to be warmer and possibly becoming unsettled as we move into Tuesday with the daylight hours, with some rainfall maybe spreading across from South Australia later on Tuesday.
Thanks, Chris.
Cheers, Warwick. Thanks
Chris
a lot.
Godfred at the Weather Bureau. Do we care if the weatherman's talking about Melbourne Cup a lot? Do you want to know that? I wonder if we do on the country. Maybe you can send us a text, 0467 842 722. You can do that anytime to get in contact with us, 0467 842 722 to text us on the Country Hour.
You're with the Country Hour, on air, online, and on the move. Join in today's broadcast at abc.net.au/rural.
Let's get a bit more serious now. With the drastic shortage of safe and affordable housing making life dangerous for workers and families in Robinvale on the Murray River, the town is the dormitory for hundreds of labourers, migrant workers and Pacific Islanders on seasonal work programs for horticulture jobs in the region. The government is hearing harrowing stories of workers being ripped off at a hearing about modern slavery, as we've brought to you so far this week on the Country Hour. Yesterday, the hearing was told there are thousands of illegal Malaysian migrants paid well below the award wage, with contractors skimming off $1 million a month. Today, Serena Locke takes us on a tour of where migrant workers are living in Robinvale, in the Sunraysia.
Now, you can see this house here on the corner, okay? And have a look at the house on the opposite corner. Now, these two homes, this caught on fire there some time ago. I'm going back about 6-7 years. And the reason caught on fire because they took a fuse wires off and put a 3-inch nail in the fuses so they can get more power into those units that you see in the back here.
These aren't units, they're sheds.
They are bloody units. That's the trouble. And this is what I'm trying to point out to officials. They are units. I know, I've been there. They're full of people in there. My name is John Case. I have lived in Robinvale for the last 60 years. At the moment, I'm a councillor with the Swan Hill Rural City Council.
And what you're describing is an incredible shortage of homes and housing for migrant workers and backpacker workers in Robinvale.
There's no doubt about it. We had some huge issues with overcrowding in homes, and you can see as I drive you by the condition some of these premises are.
Well, they're lean-to sheds in some cases, and this has got almost like rags hanging down over the top of a caravan to keep the heat off it. It must be very hot. What's it reach in summer here?
Oh, anything from 40 to 50.
40 to 50 degrees.
Yeah, especially under sheds like that, under lean-tos like this. It'd be like sitting in a frying pan when you're cooking.
you come off a hot day working on the farm. That's a bit much, isn't it?
Have a look at the one on your left there. You know how many people are in there? Have a look at the back. It's just past the jug. Not as a junkyard, but they do their own mechanical works and all that sort of thing. And
so it's a fire hazard.
Oh, it's not more. It's more than a fire hazard. It's a social hazard. It's a health hazard. You can point the finger at it and say, look, something has to be done about that, because they only have one toilet. A lot of the grey water that comes out of the caravans that are parked behind there goes on the ground, and they smells. It attracts mosquitoes. And really, at the end of the day, it's just one health hazard after the other.
How is it allowed to happen? Why aren't police raiding it for safety, or why isn't Fair Work Australia raiding, you know, places like this for safety and doing something about it? What's going wrong there with the checks and balances on that system?
Look, I've pointed this out to my council, and I've been in council now for 21 years, and out of sight, out of mind. And I don't mind saying that. I know my council would probably smack me on the wrist for it, but the truth is the truth. And even the local do-gooders don't stand up and be counted in this town. You know, I feel sometimes that I'm by myself and I have to harbour all the dislike because I bring such issues to the fore.
The local councillor, John Cattis, has persuaded the Swan Hill Council to start building more affordable homes in Robin Vale. But they need many, many more.
In my view, I'd put down 100. 100 would virtually see the issues off, the problem we face concerning the accommodation. But let's not forget too that when we talk about homes, you want families. A lot of the people we get up here now too are single people. They have lived their families in Melbourne, come up here, work for 6-9 months, then go back to Melbourne. Others come. A lot of our workers do come from Algeria, because we can't supply enough around Romville. So we've got busloads come from Algeria, and they go out towards Weeman, which is a small rural area to the southwest of Romville, and into Euston. So we have a lot of people coming in where we could have had locals.
Not travelling so far.
And not travelling, yes.
Opposite the Robin Vale School is the burnt ruins of a hostel. Blackened books and furniture, and in one room the remains of a small Buddhist shrine, still with the charred incense sticks and statues.
About 20-odd people were living in there at the time when the motel caught on fire and burned down about 5 years ago. They were very lucky they all got out. We cannot afford to have private homes become backpackers' hostels or accommodation homes. It just can't happen like this, because you end up with social issues, health issues. If they are allowed to continue like this, they become more embedded into the township system that you can't undo them anymore.
The Swan Hill Council now has agreed to new rules for rooming houses to clamp down on landlords in Robin Vale who charge rent per person, who then live 3 to 4 to a room. John Cattis says it includes providing enough toilets in the house.
And, of course, the toilets. You can't just have one toilet when you've got 10 people living under one roof. And the other thing is, too, protection from fire. Do you have sprinklers in?
Are you already getting pushback from people in the town who own new homes and are wanting to rent them out to multiple people, like, you know, perhaps 3 people per room?
Look, I get some people come to me and they complain about the drastic action that council and I might take. But the truth is, if we don't do that, then we allow ourselves to be liable for any actions that and liability that might come against not only council but against individual owners. And we don't want to see that. We don't want to see people leave Romville. We don't want to see them kicked out living under the bridge or out in the bush or along the river there. We want them to be under a roof too. But at the same time, we've got to live like human beings. The way it's happening here, people are getting unscrupulous too. All they want to do is make money. That's not good enough. You've got to think up the welfare of the community. It doesn't matter who they are.
That's John Catus, local ward rep at Robin Vale on the Swan Hill Rural City Council, taking national regional reporter Serena Locke for a drive around Robin Vale to have a look at some of the conditions there. You can tell us what you think about that. Send a text 0467 842 722. You're listening to The Country Hour, where it's 10 to 1. Let's talk avocados now. They're a common sight on brunch menus across Australia as Aussies flock for their dose of smashed avo on toast. And this year looks set to produce more locally grown fruit than ever before, with the industry forecasting a production record of 75,000 tonnes, with hopes of hitting six figures in the coming years. And as Tom Nancarrow reports, more fruit on supermarket shelves means a big win for Aussie growers.
But if you know what avocados.
Colin Fechner has been growing avocados in South Australia's Riverland since the mid-70s. He's ridden every bump that Australia's industry has had to offer. At the moment, however, it smiles all round.
It's been a learning process. We've had some failures, but the industry and the volume of fruit is definitely increasing. We're knowing how to grow them to get a crop on every year. It's very good being a grower. Most avocado growers are walking around with a smile on their face.
Consumption of the fruit is booming, and seemingly at the right time for Australia's growers. All things going to plan, the estimated 75,000 predicted tonnes of fruit set for harvest this year will be the largest crop of avocados ever produced in Australia. John Tyas is the CEO of Avocados Australia.
You don't count your chickens until they've hatched, but that's what it's looking like. We've seen growth in the Australian avocado production pretty much year on year for for a couple of decades. So it's not unexpected that that each year we'll see the levels of avocados produced in Australia continuing to increase.
And the estimates for this increase are significant. The industry is forecasting that within the coming years, Australia's production could reach 100,000 tonnes. John Tyas says that other industries are now starting to take notice.
Over the last 12 months, we've seen quite a few new people register with us, saying that they're now avocado growers. I think a lot of people from other industries are seeing the success of the avocado industry, and they want a slice of the action, I guess.
For many growers like Colin Fechner, it's vindication for sticking by a growing industry. As consumption of the fruit continues to grow, as are the prices that local growers get in their pocket.
The returns to growers probably over the last 10 years would pretty well have doubled. It is a great time to be in avocados. In fact, when the prices first started getting up into what we call very good prices 4 or 5 years ago, we keep thinking, oh, well, that's this year. Western Australia's got a big crop. New Zealand's got a big crop. We might have a small window of a couple of weeks, but the price goes up and stays up, and the volume of fruit going through the market keeps moving. The consumers are happy because fruit isn't stale. Everybody's happy.
Despite this growth, the Aussie industry is still facing gaps in supply, with imports from New Zealand still needed to fill the year-round demand. But with 100,000 tonnes on the horizon, could Australia's industry soon be facing a fruit glut? The nation's peak body is confident this can indeed be avoided, as the opening of international exports, as well as the growing fad of avocado-based desserts, will keep the fruit flying off supermarket shelves.
The marketing efforts have gone into encouraging people to use avocados at lots of different meal occasions because they can be used. You know, the smashed avocado thing, everyone knows, has gone mad. But we've traditionally used them as very much as a savoury type product. But they do work incredibly well as a sweet product. But the other thing is desserts, avocado ice cream, avocado chocolate mousse. You know, we've only just sort of on the tip of the iceberg in terms of that area of usage.
I don't know about that. That's CEO of Avocados Australia, John Tyas, speaking there with Tom Nancarrow. I'll just have it smashed on toast. I'm happy with that. Let's go to markets. A few to get through today. Let's start at Wodonga with the cattle market there. Here's Leanne Dax.
Numbers were steady with just over 1,900 cattle. Quality was excellent with very few cattle that suited restockers or feedlots. the order numbers listed, and there was an outstanding selection of grain-fed cattle, which did ignite the bidding. Heavy cattle were well supplied, but buyers this week were not as eager. Field slipped 7 to 14, trade steers were back 11, while feeder steers eased back 2. Trade heifers sold 6 cents cheaper, grown steers and bullocks slipped 3 to 6 cents. Field 275 to 324, trade steers 270 to 304, feeder steers 275 to 307, trade heifers 264 to $3, feeder heifers very few to quote 255 to 275, grown steers and bullocks 270 to 288, crossbred bullocks 262 to 272, and heavy heifers with some shape 252 to 284. I'm Leanne Dax, MLA.
Continuing on the cattle theme now, let's head south and go to Pakenham. G'day, Brendan Fletcher.
G'day, Warwick. Numbers were similar at 215, with the usual buying group present, but not all operating fully in a cheaper market. Quality declined with fewer pen lots of well-finished heavyweights and a larger proportion of leaner and lighter types. Cows were mostly 2 to 6 cents cheaper, with processors loading heavyweights for an estimated 445 to 478 cents a kilogram carcass weight. The heavy bulls eased 10 to 15. Most light and medium weight cows sold from 180 to 217, heavyweights 196 to 261, and heavy bulls 232 to 278. This is Brendan Fletcher reporting for MLA.
Thank you very much for that, Brendan. A nice and short one. Let's go to Shepparton now, and I promise not to hang up on her. Good afternoon, Nicole Cavalli.
Afternoon, Warwick. The numbers jumped as we had 1,300 exports and 600 trade cattle. Greater numbers of dairy cows and Friesian bullocks were offered. Heavy steer prices softened, as too did the beef prices, beef cow prices. Dairy cows bucked the trend, however, to be firm to 5 cents up. The trade cattle had mixed price trends. An additional restocker was present, which helped some of the leaner C2 grades of steers. The best of the yearling steers held firm. The vealers made from 2.75 to 3.20 cents, averaging around 3.13 for the vealer steers. Yearling steers B and C muscled 286 to 301, averaging around 289. Yearling heifers 269 to 286 cents, averaging 281 for the best of the C3, C4s. The 500 to 600 kilo steers 267 to 295 cents, averaging 278. 600 kilo plus bullocks made to 286 cents, averaging around 281. The manufacturing grade Friesian steers 220 to 250 cents, averaging 240. Beef cows 214 to 240 cents, averaging 235. They were 1 to 8 cents cheaper. Dairy cows $2 to 233, with the D1s averaging around 215. This is Nicole Varley from Shepparton.
Thank you very much for that, Nicole. Lucky last on the market run today. Let's go to the sheep and lamb market reports. And at Ballarat, good afternoon, Graeme Pimer.
Good afternoon, everyone. Further lift in lamb numbers as momentum continues to build towards the season peak. Saw 31,500 yarded for the usual buying group. Quality was again good with all weights on offer, including a large number of restocking lambs. Lambs generally sold $1 to $2 either side of firm. Best heavy lambs made to $198, and heavier trade weights sold from $149 to $162. They averaged around $620. Old lambs sold to $182. Restocker lambs mostly sold from 115 to 140. Lighter weights made from 53 to 95. And shorn young lambs sold from 83 to 123.50. Then a first cross young ewes made to $192. Lamb sales still in progress. There's about 9,000 sheep still to be sold. Trade weight three score lambs made from 125 to 140 and averaged around 645. Heavier trade weights made from 149 to 162 and averaged around 620. Export 3 and 4 score lambs sold from 161 to 198, around 610 to 615. It's been Graeme Pimer at Ballarat for MLA.
Thank you very much for that, Graeme. No Nicole Tavastek to preview the program this afternoon, but she'll be on your radio from 3 o'clock. Just to give us a quick chance to have a look at the text line and the Twitter line as well on the Country House. Stuart is a big defender of Chris Godfrey, says Chris Godfrey's a legend. He's our weatherman for today. So much useful detail, particularly important spraying, shearing and trying to work among showers. Thanks, Stuart. Thanks for the tick of approval. We'll pass that on to Chris for you as well. And I do love this text that has come in from Peter at Meetung, who said, Country Hour, a reminder to all country regions who contributed to the success by the men and horses of the Australian Light Horse Charge at Beersheba 100 years ago today. Thank you very much for that text, Peter. Of course, and Landline did a lovely feature on that. If you've missed that, you can find that on iView as well. And just on a note on that, given we've got time anyway, looking at the history of Bathsheba today, I did get to find out about Tibby Cotter, an Australian pre-World War I fast bowler. And I was reading about that earlier today, and I implore you to do the same. He died at Bathsheba 100 years ago, if you'd like to know that link of history. Thanks for everyone being involved in our program. Remember our Facebook page, Victorian Country Hour on Facebook. You can see a famous AFL player who's been selling his cattle at sale yards. I wouldn't want to be in the paddock if he was mustering me. If you want to check that out, go to Victorian Country Hour on Facebook. Otherwise, check us out on the same time on your radio tomorrow. That's it for us.